Across America. Live, this is Point of View. And now, Pitta Dexter.
Thank you very much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. I am sitting in for Kirby today. I believe he is returning today from, and I don't know if you all know this, but we actually have a station in North Pole, Alaska. And that's where Kirby's been the last few days. He went up to visit the station up there and held an event, and he's on his way back. He'll, I'm sure, tell you about it. We sometimes get callers from North Pole, Alaska, and I think it's a lot of fun. I am so excited about my in-studio guest today. I have Van Taylor, congressman from the 3rd District of Texas, and I've known Van just because he's represented me in my neighborhood, both in the Texas House, Texas Senate, and now in the U.S. Congress. Van, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be with you and all of your listeners.
Well, it's good to have you. I just do want to mention, because it's been fun sitting here, I didn't know some of these things about
Oh,
you.
Sure.
I knew that you were a Iraq war veteran, that you served right. in the Marines, that you were decorated. And I did not know that you live in near the land that your great-grandfather farmed during the Depression, that you're a seventh-generation Texan.
Yep. My family actually came to Texas in 1826.
You don't even have an accent.
Well, I think as America becomes more broad, accents are becoming more in the past. But.
I noticed that because I came to Plano from California, and the people around me in Plano don't have, well, many of them are transplants
sure.
anyway. And
right.
Since you're in that area of Texas, you probably are not surrounded by native Texans.
Yeah.
Well, Van Taylor, you know, he's just one of those people who kind of was successful in business and decided he wanted to serve. You served in the military, and now you're serving our country in Congress. And there are so many issues facing us. I think it has to be a little bit frustrating now to be in the House with the Democrats in control, is it?
Well, I think, as you mentioned in your intro, I served in the Texas legislature, and that is a very competent legislative body, certainly in comparison to Congress. I liken it to having served in the Marine Corps and, kind of complain about how the Marine Corps can't get anything done. It doesn't work. And then I did a joint NATO exercise. And I met the Bulgarian Army. And so every complaint I may have ever had about the Marine Corps went away at that point. And you realize,
really?
Okay, we're a really great organization. And so when I talked to my friends in the Texas legislature and they tell me about how difficult it was, and I said, look, you guys passed a budget, you're nearly unanimously, you rewrote the entire school finance code this session unanimously, in Congress we haven't passed a budget on time in 17 years. I mean, you got nothing, honestly, you have nothing to complain about. The Texas legislature is a very, very competent legislative body, they get their work done, they passed every budget on time since 1963, and Congress is unfortunately the opposite.
And they do it every other year in a 5-month period most
yep.
of the time.
Absolutely, yeah. I know they usually get the job done in 140 days, which is 20 weeks, and they get a lot done. And clearly, they've done a great job running the state of Texas. I mean, the state of Texas is a successful state because of the people that are here. That's the most important thing. But the government in Texas has made some good choices, and we're very blessed in Collin County to have great schools and safe streets. And businesses every day come from blue states talking about how they're worried about the fiscal solvency of the state, how they're worried about traffic, how they're worried about high taxes, and how they just can't recruit people to come into those states anymore, and that they're coming to Collin County because they think that they can recruit people.
Well, they are, and that is something that folks are worried about, I think.
Sure.
Because I actually saw this, I think it was today or yesterday in the Washington Post. Here it is. It's a piece on the Washington Post. Take Texas seriously. GOP anxiety spikes after retirements and Democratic gains. And I also know that people in Collin County, because we've had so many businesses relocate there, they worry a little bit about just the tenor, the conservatism,
sure.
the conservative
sure.
values being changed, attacked. And then I hear on the other side that, no, the people that are coming because of those values.
Right.
They're not going to change them. What do you think?
Sure. Well, I think there was an exit poll done during the senatorial race in last election, so 2018, and Senator Cruz actually won the transplants, and he lost the native Texans.
Oh, really?
I've had a while to sort of think about that. You know, what does that mean? And I think it means, and I've talked to quite a few native Texans, I think on some level you become complacent. You know, when you live in a AAA bond rated state, you just assume, well, we're going to be fiscally solvent. We're going to pass a balanced budget. We're going to, you know, keep government small and freedom strong, and we're going to be a successful state. But the people that come from, you know, California or Illinois or New York can tell you, no, you know, we don't live in AAA bond rated states. We live in states that have really serious fiscal problems, that are, you know, putting prisoners in tents, that are not building roads, that are not funding their pension funds, that have very high tax burdens. And this is unsustainable. And you're not watching those states really try to right the ship. They're continuing to double down, continue to not fund their pension funds, continue to raise taxes, to not build roads. So the things that they're doing, is causing businesses to leave. I'll just share a quick anecdote. I was talking to, the CEO of Toyota North America, Jim Lentz, who, you know, is now in Plano, and they've moved a 2 million They had a 2 million square foot facility in Torrance, California. It's now in Plano. They've built a new one in Plano, Texas. We're very proud to have them. And I said, you know, what's your big surprise? And he said, you know, honestly, the big surprise to me was how much the commute was impacting my employees. And so the average commute was 45 minutes each way, in Torrance, California for his employees. And that's dropped down to about 15 minutes each way. He said, look, having an hour of your life, to be with your family, to spend time to yourself, whatever it may be, that was a big deal. And he said, I just didn't realize how big a deal, how much life it was sucking
because
out of
you
my...
you just get used to it.
You get used to it, and you're just kind of, that's just, you assume that that's the way it should be. But no, and look, I was at, last week I was with Raytheon. They're opening up, they're adding 500 employees for a very high-tech manufacturing plant, up in McKinney, Texas. Very proud of that. And, you know, and again, they can put it in Billerica, Massachusetts. They can put it in El Segundo, California. They've got choices. They can go a lot of places to, but they, again and again, when I talk to them, particularly the HR people, and I think those are the most important people to talk to, why are you choosing to be here? They say, look, when I'm trying to get somebody to move, from another location to come to McKinney, Texas, that's easy. I can do that all day long. But when I used to do that in California, it was really hard.
That's really true. You know, I actually came here from California. That Toyota headquarters was very close to where I lived.
Ah.
And people's commutes to Torrance, California is nothing compared to people's commutes from that area downtown or something like that. So the driving factor is a big deal. But I think people can get used to that. I think the problem, though, is all of a sudden you as a middle-class American – really don't count anymore. It's either those who have to be taken care of or the very rich who are actually targeted now for taxation. And so it's just harder and harder to be a normal, hardworking American and live in places like that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and just on the traffic point, I'll quantify what I'm saying. You know, between 2002 and 2012, Texas, with 8% of the U.S. population and a 20-cent a gallon gas tax, built 5,000 lane miles of state highway. In that same decade, California, with 12% of the U.S. population, so 50% more people, and a gas tax of 42.5 cents a gallon, which is 100+% more, built 11 miles of state highway.
Ladies and gentlemen, next up we're going to talk about a bill that Representative Taylor introduced that you will want to hear about. We'll be right back.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
Next week, Congress will reconvene and feel the pressure to do something about guns and gun violence. Some Democratic presidential candidates have proposed a number of federal gun policies. They range from implementing a mandatory government buyback program to requiring every American to obtain a federal license to purchase a firearm. Some call for banning assault weapons. Most call for universal background checks. The members of Congress promoting these various gun policies cite a number of polls that document public frustration with shootings and congressional inaction. But they might want to look deeper into these polls to understand what American voters really feel are appropriate policies. Sometimes Americans tell pollsters they want congressional action but aren't really ready to pay for it. You might remember my commentary last month on climate change. Americans said they want Congress to address this environmental issue, but a majority said they were only willing to spend a dollar a month on the issue. A Pew Research Center study on the demographics of gun ownership found that nearly a majority of American adults live in a household with a firearm. That percentage is even higher for rural Americans. Nearly three-quarters of Americans who own guns said they can't see themselves not owning one. Most proponents of universal background checks argue that they would require a national gun registry. That would be the only way the government could determine if a transaction was made in compliance. How many of those Americans I just mentioned who live in a household with a firearm feel comfortable about having their firearms registered with the federal government? Americans may be calling for congressional action, but I suspect some members of Congress and various candidates have misread what voters would find acceptable. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
From Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers, Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire, rated PG, now playing in theaters. Overcomermovie.com.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Welcome back to Point of View. Congressman Van Taylor is with me in studio. He represents the 3rd District in the state of Texas, and... Van, you know, there was a beloved congressman here, Sam Johnson, whose seat you took, and I just think I was thrilled when you were running for it, and I'm glad you're there.
Yeah, well, I'll just say that, you know, Sam Johnson is a very special human being.
Yeah.
He served 29 years in the Air Force, and 7 of those were in the Hanoi Hilton as a POW in Vietnam, and he was just an incredible human being, and I will say the very best day I had in the Texas legislature was introducing him on the floor of the Senate.
I can imagine.
Well, just the reaction of people when they hear his story. And you know, look, of all the people in the Hanoi Hilton, he was the only American that never signed anything, never confessed. And he was, the North Vietnamese were very, very angry with him. They actually, in 1969, when Ho Chi Minh died, they took all the Americans out of solitary confinement and put them in a group, except for one man, Sam Johnson, because he wouldn't break.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he got an extra 9 months of solitary confinement. He actually went on a hunger strike, nearly killed himself. Admiral Stockdale said, "Hey, feed yourself, Sam. We'll go on a hunger strike. We'll get you out." And they did. The Americans went on a hunger strike, and they got Sam out of solitary. But yeah, he's a very special human being, and has a tremendous story of sacrifice for this country.
And he served well in Congress, and a deserved retirement.
Sure,
now.
Absolutely.
He's still active. You see him around town.
He's still around town.
So that's fun. Well, I do. Speaking of the military, you've got a great bill
that you
have introduced. It's called the Gold Star Children Act. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, you know, so I have 100% meeting policy. So I've met with every constituent that's ever has to have a meeting with me, it's ramped up a little bit as a member of Congress. I'm up to almost.
I don't know if you ought to announce that on radio.
Oh,
you're going to be so busy.
I've had 270 meetings so far my first 8 months in office. And so, and then I have coffees with their congressman. So I've actually had my 21st coffee with their congressman last Friday. One in McKinney and then one in Melissa, Texas. And, in the coffees with their congressman, I had someone show up and say, "Look, I'm a veteran. And did you know that we provide a Gold Star, a Gold Star mother, would be a mother whose son or daughter died in combat. And so we give a hiring preference to Gold Star parents, Gold Star spouse, but not to Gold Star children. And it certainly does happen where, the Gold Star children is taking care of the Gold Star mom, or dad.
Okay.
Had a series of conversations and checked on that and found out, you know, indeed that was the case. There was no hiring preference for, Gold Star children. And so, went about, drafting the law, having conversations with different groups that would be important. And then filed that. And actually have bipartisan support, Republican and Democrat. Mm-hmm. I am actually a founding member of a bipartisan caucus called, Four Country. And Four Country, has 19 members, 10 Democrats and 9 Republicans. And we're all post 9/11 veterans, right? So we all served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, and we try to work on a bipartisan basis to get things done, that are gonna help the country. And so this Gold Star Act is something that we're proud to have filed and have bipartisan support. It's a great thing.
Well, it is great. And just the idea of getting bipartisan support on things is kind of different right now. It's a little bit out there, but it's important. And, you know, you're in a hostile environment in a sense right now.
Yeah.
But I do want to ask you about a couple of things while
sure.
I have you, because we're seeing all these proposals for basically socialist programs, Medicare
right,
for
right.
all, the Green New Deal.
Sure.
And the way that is being proposed to pay for it is really things like a wealth tax
mm-hmm.
or capital gains being realized at death,
mm-hmm.
and so that the heirs get taxed. Things that bring money more immediately into the federal government but are
sure.
big tax bills. So I just, you know, as you're there in Congress now seeing this and figuring out how to react to these socialist plans,
sure.
what are you thinking about? I mean, how are they going to really realistically fund these things if they get them?
Well, I'll make this comment. You know, I was in college. I read a lot of Karl Marx, and so that enough to make me a pretty deep, pretty strong conservative. And I actually had to go. And I, you know, when the Soviet Union fell, I kind of thought, well, look, this socialism thing is over. It's done. We're not going to have to deal with this anymore. And I kind of put the Marx Engels reader on the shelf and just kind of sat there. But when I got to Congress, I actually had to break that down and reread the Communist Manifesto.
Who would have thought?
And it's surprising to what extent the Communist Manifesto really is embodied in a lot of things that I hear, unfortunately, from my colleagues in the halls of Congress. So, whereas I thought communism was something I would fight maybe on the battlefield as a Marine, growing up in America in the 80s, I find that I'm actually fighting it in the halls of Congress, you know, here, in 2019.
Well, I'm glad you studied it, because I think for your next few terms, you will be fighting it.
I think so. You know, look, in 1920, 100 years ago, there were five people running for president, one Republican, one Democrat, independent, and two socialists. So you've had a socialist party in this country for a long time, but they were trying to be their own party.
Yeah.
And so now you're watching socialists try to take over the Democrat Party. And so that's a big change in tactics for the socialists. You know, and they're able to label things well. So when you ask the question, when you poll the question, you know, do you support Medicare for all? A lot of Americans are very, very happy with that idea. And what they think is, well, that's going to be health care for kind of everybody else who's uninsured. And there are, you know, tens of millions of Americans who are uninsured. But it's not hundreds of millions of Americans, right? You got 330 million mm-hmm. Americans, 158 million Americans, almost half are on employer-based insurance. But when you go and say, hey, you know, Medicare for All means canceling the health care of every single American, you know, we will no longer have a VA, we will no longer have any private insurance of any kind, you know, you're going to lose your health care, Americans very quickly say, I don't want to do that. That is too extreme, that's too much. I don't want to see that much government. I don't want to have to go to Washington, D.C. and beg for a health care procedure. And, you know, and as a member of Congress, I see that on a regular basis with just the Medicare program as it is, where people say, hey, mm-hmm. could you pay for this equipment? Could you pay for this procedure? Could you pay for this drug? It's not covered. It needs to be covered. And so imagine that on everything. Imagine, every single healthcare procedure is then covered by the federal government. You're going to be working with your congressman trying to ask for your own healthcare back. And that's just not an America I think that Americans like. They like the idea of freedom and personal responsibility. That they're in control of their own lives.
I don't think most Americans think the government would be able to really do it well either.
No, and there's certainly great concerns about the ability of the federal government to control that. And let me just make this point. You know, in 1900, 8% of U.S. GDP went to government. It's now 42%. If you do a Medicare for all, that's taking the federal government to controlling almost 2/3 of the economy. And if you only control 1/3 of what you make, are you free? And I would submit you're not. I think that as government grows, as the government is bigger, we're less free. We're less in control of our own destiny and our own lives. And I think giving the federal government total and absolute control of healthcare in this country is not something that people ultimately will decide to do. I think, well, we're going to have a debate. It's going to be a very, very interesting presidential election.
Yes.
Because it is truly seminal. You know, what path will we go down? Are we going to go down the path of socialism? Are we going to have for bigger government? And look, when government controls 2/3 of the economy, they're very much in control. And that's going to be one choice. And then the other choice of, are we going to choose to be for freedom and personal responsibility and people being in control of their own lives?
All right. So taking economics down a level.
Sure.
Congress passed a minimum wage bill, $15 minimum wage bill. And now I see that there's even a push to move it up to $20.
Right.
And I just think minimum wages are a bad idea all the way around, right. And we've fought it here in Texas, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what was the debate like?
Sure.
Are a lot of Republicans, just because it kind of polls well, just jumping on to that?
You're not seeing Republicans jump onto that, at least in Congress. I was on the Education and Labor Committee, and that is actually where that bill was voted out of, and so it was part of the debate in committee on that. And you know, a lot of Democrats said, "Look, you know, we're not going to lose any jobs over this." And I said, "Well, you know, if you look at what happened in Seattle, Seattle, to their credit, the city council when they did a minimum wage, they kind of phased it over a series of years." They actually told the University of Washington to come in and do a study.
Right.
And as they studied it, they found that the total payroll actually went down. Employers reduced jobs, so jobs were lost, but the number of hours decreased, and the number of hours decreased so much so that the total payroll actually declined in Seattle. So you have a real world example where, you know, gee, the minimum wage ended up making the working Americans worse off than they were before. And the reason for that is that automation, right? So that an employer says, yeah, you know, gee, I've got to pay more in salary. So guess what? I'm going to have fewer employees and I'm going to have more machines. I'm going to go to kiosk ordering. I'm going to put an automated dishwashing machine in. I'm not going to do it by manual anymore. I'm going to automate my processes more and squeeze more efficiencies out and just have less labor, and lower the labor component. And so a minimum wage accelerates automation. It decreases employment and decreases the total take-home pay for employees in the places where they've done a higher minimum wage has actually gone down. So I think you could say it hasn't worked. And the other thing,
a few seconds till the end of
what I said in committee is I held up the bill and I said, if you guys really thought we wouldn't lose jobs, why did you stop at $15?
I know. You could go $100.
Yeah. Why not go to $100?
The concept is the same. Representative Taylor, thank you so much for serving us in Congress and for being with me today.
Sure. Great to be with you.
And we'll be back.
We live in a digital generation. Point of View is reaching this often overly plugged-in generation with truth. You can keep up with us 24 hours a day using your phone, your tablet, your laptop, or your desktop. Search for the Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, where you can keep up with today's issues, learn about current and upcoming guests by liking us on Facebook. Also, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @PointOfViewRTS. That stands for Point of View Radio Talk Show. Learn, interact, make a difference with Point of View using new media. And here's one way you can make a big difference. Help us increase our reach by spreading the word among your friends. Share a Facebook post. Tag us in a tweet. With enough joining us to plant seeds, we'll see a tremendous harvest. Come on, it only takes a minute. Search for Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, @PointOfViewRTS on Twitter, and subscribe to the Point of View Radio Talk Show channel on YouTube. Learn, interact, share. The Point of View Radio Talk Show. Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Pina Dexter.
Our thanks to Congressman Van Taylor for coming into the studio. He's in frequently to talk with Kirby, and we're so glad that he is because it's good to hear how things are going in Washington, D.C. I'm sure that it's frustrating and difficult now for him as he's now in the minority, serving in a Congress that's controlled by Democrats. But he is one who likes to get things done across the aisle, and that's good that we have somebody from Texas doing that. I will mention he was a U.S. Marine, and my next guest in studio was also a U.S. Marine. He is Christopher Towne, and he's a volunteer with Texas Right to Life and has a big job ahead of him right now, heading up the 40 Days for Life campaign for the city of Plano. It's something that has kind of, languished a little, and now he's bringing back. Christopher, thank you so much for being here. Tell us about 40 Days for Life.
Well, thank you for having me. 40 Days of Life is a peaceful prayer vigil that starts from September 25th through November 3rd, and it's a 12-hour prayer vigil for 7 days.
Every day for 7 days?
Yes, seven days a week. So it's 40 days straight. So again, we're just looking for volunteers to come out there, pray with us, and just be part of that vigil. It's going to be in front of the Plano Planned Parenthood, and we're just on the grassy area out front of there praying for the individuals that go inside and the children and the mothers.
Do you talk to people, too, as they go in?
We will reach out to them if they're willing. So,
I'm thinking of yeah. Unplanned.
Yeah.
And that scenario that was depicted. And a lot of people never understood what those prayers were like outside of abortion facilities until they saw Unplanned.
Yeah.
And so is it kind of like that?
Yeah. So Unplanned, Abby Johnson, the company itself, or the parent company, 40 Days for Life, was the same organization that actually got her out of Planned Parenthood.
Really?
So it's exactly like Unplanned, with the same organization trying to do the same thing, just pray for the individuals and really doing it as a community. It's something that's going on, like I said, September 25th through November 3rd, but it's over 100 communities in the United States alone that are actually doing it at the same time.
All at the same time?
Yes.
Wow. So it's kind of like a spiritual thing in a sense, because everybody is doing this and praying all at once.
Yeah, yeah. So again, with that, a lot of people that actually do this, at least 95% reported that they had spiritual growth through this period. So it's all about fasting, praying, and really just getting to know the Lord and reaching out to our community about this issue.
So Chris, if people are listening and want to be involved in this, mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's a huge commitment. I mean, it's a big commitment, but in a sense, you're piggybacking on each other,
yeah.
right? So you're not doing this. You're not committing to do this all day, every day.
No, no. So you could pick if you want to do every Thursday for 1 hour, or just maybe try it out for 1 hour for the entire 40 days. It's really up to you, the level of commitment that you want to have. If you want to go online to sign up, you could go to 40daysforlife.com/Plano. And, it's a great opportunity. It's really what you feel called by the Spirit, to really volunteer for.
I understand you've got an event coming up to sort of kick this off.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to have our kickoff rally, and that's going to be at Haggard Park. The address there is 901 East 15th Street, Plano, Texas, 75074. And that's going to be September 21st, Saturday at 6:30 p.m. And we're going to have Jennifer Shelton. She's one of the directors for one of the crisis pregnancy centers around here.
Yeah, Real Options for Women.
Yes, 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 that's exactly right.
That's a great organization.
Yeah, from what I hear from all the churches out there, she's just a very motivational speaker, somebody that could really just bring the Spirit to you. Then after that, immediately after that, we're going to have a movie, and that's going to be October Baby. So you could come there, you could sign up for the vigil at that time, but the event itself is open to the public, so really just come have a good time, really with the full body of believers.
A bunch of pro-lifers hanging out together on September 21st at Haggard Park. Actually, it's right by the Art Center of Plano.
Yes.
This is a question that I have, just brings up in my mind. I never think about the Planned Parenthood in Plano.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one.
Yes.
And do you know anything about the numbers of abortions that take place there?
Well, that is actually not an abortion facility. They actually refer everybody to other Planned Parenthoods. But the way I look at it and the way we look at it, Texas Right to Life, is, you know, we want to get that individual before they buy the car instead of picking up the car.
Yeah.
So every opportunity we have really to influence those individuals to make a decision for Christ and to make a decision that's going to really progress this issue, we want to be there.
So this Planned Parenthood then in Plano is not one that's going to have to make any changes with this new, order by the president and by HHS, correct? Because they don't have abortions taking place at their facility.
Well, with that being said, I heard that Planned Parenthood as a whole opted out to receive government funds. So really,
so they won't receive any even for a facility that does not do abortions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they opted out to receive any type of funds. So they're losing next fiscal year, they'll be losing roughly around $60 million.
Yeah, it's a drop in the bucket to what they bring in, but
yeah.
It's always been just terrible, egregious that our government would be funneling money to Planned Parenthood.
Yeah. It's, you know, really, there's supposed to be that separation between, you know, where our money goes to. And sometimes, you know, that could get a little blurry when the same organization is taking part of that.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I mean, I think the bugaboo was that they were taking place at the same location. But really, any Planned Parenthood that is giving out, you know, medical appointments and pap smears and all of that, pregnancy tests, they're referring.
Yeah, they're referring them.
They're referring for abortion.
So, again, they have abortion counselors is the way I would say it, that they come in, they get their, they find out they're pregnant, or individuals find out they're pregnant, and then they could sit down and really have that discussion with those individuals trying to persuade them to have one. And that's the business that they're kind of in. And you got to understand, every person they persuade, you know, that's more money that they are taking in. And if the person does decide not to have the abortion at that time, they're going to receive phone calls from Planned Parenthood for the next eight months.
They are.
Yeah, trying to still convince them to come back and have that abortion. So it's a nonstop
nasty
process.
Business.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I do want to ask you about not only that event and what's going on, but also just in sort of broadening it a little bit.
Yeah.
We're thinking about and we're looking at the composition of, for instance, the U.S. Supreme Court and all the courts across the country, and seeing that there might be a possibility in not that distant of a future that Roe versus Wade would be overturned.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen this past year, and I'm sure you've been watching, some states going to very restrictive abortion laws. I mean, I think they're good. Heartbeat bills, things like that. And then you've seen other states saying, no, we want to make sure and pave the way for abortion to be legal all the way up to the moment of birth. So we've been seeing that divide. What do you think about it, especially with regard to the state of Texas? I mean, we've had some pretty strong restrictions, but we've also had them challenged, haven't we?
We have, and in the past, Texas has been one of those states that have been very pro-life when it comes to our own Texas, you know, Congress. But with that, lately, it's something that it's hard to get those issues out of committee. So really, just again, going into that, we need to. And my motto is really, you know, always think about pro-life issues before I vote, and who I'm voting for to get into that is really bring those people forth, because we had the same, you know, heartbeat law in committee this year, but it never made it out. So again, it's something that if we want to see a change here in the Texas area, we need to make sure we're getting the right people in there to really push that into that issue.
Yeah, I've been very happy with some of the people. Like, for instance, that heartbeat bill, our friend who's been a guest on this show a lot, Briscoe Kane, introduced that. But then you get the leadership and the different committee heads that bottle things up. And so, you know, I don't know how that would have come out in the end, but I know they're going to keep trying. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got Chris Towne with us, and we will continue after the break on this issue of abortion. I noticed there was a piece in the news about the city of Austin where it's actually billing itself, or actually Texas Right to Life has billed it, as a sanctuary for the abortion industry. I'll talk about that with Chris Towne in just a moment. And also, if you would like to weigh in on this or ask us a question or report something that has to do with this issue, give us a call at 800-351-1212. This is Point of View, and we would love to hear from you and hear your point of view on that very issue. And then a little bit later in the program, we've got some other great guests. Sally Pipes is going to join us, and Van Taylor brought up the whole idea of Medicare for all. She's going to tell us how this would affect senior citizens. You don't want to miss that. That's in the next hour. We'll be back.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
My guest is Christopher Towne, and he is with Texas Right to Life. He is an ambassador for the 40 Days for Life program. He's leading the 40 Days for Life campaign. Is it for Collin County?
It's for anybody that wants to volunteer.
Okay.
More than welcome you.
Do we have them in the other counties around, like Dallas County? Is there a 40 Days for Life
There is a 40 days. It's going to be happening right up here off of Greenville. So, yes, there is one at the Southwestern. So if you just want to log on and find the one closest to you, you can, again, go to the 40daysforlife.com, and then that will be able to search the location that is closer, the closest to you.
I encourage you, ladies and gentlemen, to get involved in this. It's been going on for quite a while, and it's lots of pro-life organizations participate, don't they? Or is it just National Right to Life?
That's the 40 Days for Life, and with Texas Right to Life is the one that's actually helping the Plano Planned Parenthood. So, again, with this whole trying to get
organized.
I love
how you say helping the Planned Parenthood, helping them understand what we believe.
Again, with this, I've been in contact with many churches, so there's a lot of organizations there. You have a lot of great organizations and churches that's helping out.
This is something that you can really do to make a difference, ladies and gentlemen. I do want to kind of clarify, in case, I don't know if Kirby covered this, but this has been in the news recently, that Planned Parenthood made a decision because the Trump administration issued a rule about funding through Title X.
Mm-hmm.
If any kind of like services, reproductive services, pregnancy testing, all of that for poor women especially, is offered in a location, this rule from HHS said that if you're doing abortions, you can't get any Title X money. Well, Planned Parenthood made the decision to forego the Title X money and just keep doing the abortions and not make any changes in the way they do that. And that's just sort of hitting this week.
Yeah, and that's something that's really huge. It really shows you their intentions behind what they're actually doing. They're willing to forego the money that they would receive from Congress just to continue that one process.
Yeah, that one murderous process. All right, I wanted to mention this because I saw this came from Texas Right to Life. Members of the Austin City Council announced an initiative to use taxpayer dollars to drive women to and from their abortion appointments. So Texas Right to Life is calling Austin a sanctuary city for the abortion industry. The city may, they're thinking about this. They may grant up to $150,000 to organizations like the Lilith Fund, others that are pro-abortion, paying for transportation, lodging, and child care for women seeking an abortion, making it a lot easier. Council members in Austin proposed a budget amendment that would funnel money through the Austin Public Health Department, not to fund abortions directly, but to fund these organizations. So, again, trying to get around people's aversion to it, but still doing it.
And what's sad about that, too, is here in Plano, there's an organization called Turning Point that is actually trying to receive money from the Plano City to actually have the abortion pill to provide it to individuals.
Really?
So they actually had a discussion about it last Saturday, and I believe it's coming up to vote. So it's just not Austin. It's other locations. It's one right near us here in Plano. And with that, though, on the flip side, it's always a great thing that we see cities like Mineral Wells that are passing sanctuary cities for the pro-life. And there's other locations out here in Texas that's doing the same. So
so they're sanctuary cities for babies. They say there will be no abortion clinics in this city.
Yes, and that's a great thing. You know, you have one city that might be more more pro-life that's taking that steps really to identify, hey, we want to be able to be in that process to help children, help childs, help the unborn to actually come into this world.
Yeah, and it's I read an article about another city in the eastern end of the state that did this, and it was just fun because you had the citizens. I mean, some were not happy about it, of course, but many were, and they loved being kind of, they were just proud of being part of a city that stood for life or a town. And you know, some of these towns are so small that they probably would not have an abortion clinic, but just the idea that they take that stand, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah, and I think if churches in their own communities would be willing to just go to their city councils and demand that we do the same, it's just going to really help us in the pro-life community, showing that our commitment to this you know, cause.
Yeah. All right, 40 Days for Life. And again, Chris, before we get too close to the end, I want to ask you to just tell people how they can get involved, kind of give some encouragement in that direction.
Yeah. So again, if just log on to 40 Days for Life. You can log on to 40daysforlife.com/Plano and sign up for vigil hours. Sign up there. Again, sign up as much as you can. Really sign up as much as Spirit is telling you to do. Even if it's an hour, even if it's an hour every Thursday, whatever it might be, it's helping the cause. It's showing to our community of just the atrocities that are going on there. And if you're not able to log on, or if you want to come to our kickoff rally, again, you could go ahead and do that. That's going to be on September 21st at 6:30 p.m. in Hager Park in Plano.
So, in a sense, I'm thinking it would be fun to do this with friends.
Yeah.
With my kids or something.
Yeah, yeah.
The more the merrier, right?
I'm going to have my kids out there with me.
Are you?
So just really, teach them the value of life while they're young.
Yeah, and hopefully the weather cools off, so it'll be a little bit more comfortable to do it. Well, here's just one more story that I'll have you comment on. This was in Life News, and a bunch of Hollywood stars are, they've been recruited by Planned Parenthood to advertise abortion.
Wow.
Sort of messaging. And the picture on the front of this first article was a picture of Miley Cyrus, so she's one of them. I mean, these are big stars. Ariana Grande, for instance, is another one. Halsey, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Nicki Minaj. And so they've all signed on, and it's called Bans Off My Body.
Yeah. And it's sad that we have our society now that they're able to continue to push this message. Back when Roe versus Wade was passed, it was, we really don't know the science by it, so we're going to go ahead and trust that it's not a formed baby. But if you could actually look in the pictures now, and you could see when the baby's formed, up to, at 3 weeks, one day, the baby's breathing. So there's really not an issue of them not saying, hey, it's tissues or a clump of cells. You could look into the side of the womb and see that. And the sad thing that I see now is people aren't saying, oh, it might be a clump of cells. We don't know, but yeah, we know it's a baby. And we still have the right to go ahead and murder it.
Yeah, and this whole movement of shout my abortion.
Yeah.
Like you're proud of it.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really says something sad about our culture and our society.
Yeah, and I just think really the individuals that are with that, hopefully the Holy Spirit could work with them and just continue to bring them back to His will.
Yeah. Yeah, so Leanna Wen, who was short time president for Planned Parenthood, declared that Americans want bodily autonomy instead of bans on abortion care. Bodily autonomy, but, that's a baby separate from the mother.
Yeah.
And, we all know that now. Science is speaking that very loudly. And it's just so wonderful that a lot of people's, everybody's first baby picture now is their sonogram.
Yeah.
So that is a human life. Well, listen, Chris, thank you for what you're doing. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to encourage you to get involved in 40 Days for Life. If you're in Collin County, then you can do it there. You can do it all around the area. Just go to the 40 Days for Life website. Thank you so much for joining me today, Chris.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Ladies and gentlemen, next up, we're going to talk with Sally Pipes. She's written extensively about what Medicare for All would mean for senior citizens. It's not good. We'll be back.
It wasn't long ago, it seemed, every official decision brought religious liberty and our ability to live as faithful Christians into question. Some of us wondered how long it would be before we were literally forced to choose between obeying God or men. That pressure seems to have subsided just a bit, and now is the time not to take a breath, but to work as hard as we can for the future of our nation. Thanks to you, Point of View is doing just that. And our special thanks to those who have become members of Truth Team 360. In football, 22 guys battle it out on the field while 40 or 60,000 watch in the stands and perhaps hundreds of thousands more watch on television. We need a special few to get out of the seats and into the game. Join today by calling 1-800-347-5151 and ask to join the Truth Team. or visit us online at pointofview.net/team. We really do need you. The nation needs you. 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net/team. Point of View will continue after this.
Across America, live, this is Point of View.
And now, Pina Dexter.
Thank you very much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, for Point of View. We've got a lot ahead here on the program. Carrie Lucas is going to join me, and she has written, it's actually a pamphlet, something you might want to order, called Checking Progressive Privilege. You know, we've all heard of white privilege, male privilege. There's also exists in this culture progressive privilege, and it's so pervasive that we almost don't realize it's there. Carrie is head of Independent Women's Forum, a great organization, and she will be joining me to talk about that in the last hour of the program. And then we're also going to speak with Lori Roman. She has started an organization called the AND Fund, Hope and Help for Special Needs and Seriously Ill Children and Their Families. And these are special families, adoptive families, families who adopt children who have special needs. And you know, if you are an adoptive parent, that there are often a lot of unexpected surprises. You just, more than just having your own children, which also brings its share of surprises. But if you adopt special needs kids, and if you take that step, you usually weigh the pros and cons, and can you handle this? And then things come up that you never expected. So the AND Fund exists to help people with those things, especially financially. And so Lori Roman started it. It's a fairly new organization, and I was so interested when I met her. I wanted to have her on, so she will be joining me also in the final hour of Point of View. And then in a few minutes, in the next segment, I'm going to be joined by Sally Pipe. She's an expert in healthcare issues, and she's written a book. Well, actually not a book. She has written several books. But what I wanted to talk to her about today was how, not Obamacare. She's written a lot about Obamacare, how Medicare for All would affect seniors and how this would bring really dangerous rationing to the system. It just has to. Her article is Medicare for All Would Be Hazardous to the Health of Seniors. Ration care could be deadly. So Sally Pipes will join me. But I wanted to get back to one issue that I discussed in the last hour with Representative Van Taylor. I'm so glad that he was here in studio. It's more fun sometimes to do interviews in studio rather than by phone. We can't get everybody in studio because they're all over the country, but we had a couple of people who live in the area come in the first hour, so that was fun. But this Washington Post piece takes Texas seriously. GOP anxiety spikes after retirements and Democratic gains. And, you know, the Washington Post loves to stir up anything that is favorable to the left. And so I think with Van Taylor, he was reassuring to say that, no, Texas is very much a leader, very red still, and we don't need to worry about, for instance, we have a lot of companies coming in because we're so prosperous, moving their headquarters here. We don't need to worry that that will change the tenor of the state and make us more liberal, make us more purple rather than red. But the Washington Post says that even Ted Cruz is worried about it. Here's how the article starts. Republicans have long idealized Texas as a deep red frontier state, home to rural conservatives who love President Trump, but political turbulence in the sprawling suburbs, and that's true. The Dallas, Fort Worth, even Austin, Houston, much more liberal than some of the outlying cities. And also the fast growth, it says, are turning the Lone Star state into a possible 2020 battleground. And this is what Ted Cruz says. The president's reelection campaign needs to take Texas seriously. He said that while he remains optimistic about the GOP's chances, and I'm quoting him, it's by no means a given that Trump will carry Texas and its 38 electoral votes next year, or even that Senator John Cornyn will be reelected. So that's an interesting take by Ted Cruz. I don't know if the Washington Post is distorting that at all, but that's what he said, and a lot of this is in quotes. We have some changing demographics in Texas and a wave of liberal activism in the state that have given new hope for Democrats. And, of course, we have had some famous retirements. Representative Will Hurd, he was a rising star, but he's not going to seek reelection. He's in a competitive district that stretches east from El Paso along the Mexican border. Another congressman, Representative Michael Conaway, who was a committee chairman from West Texas, announced he will not run again. Same with Representative Pete Olson, who narrowly won his seat in 2018. 2 years earlier, he carried his suburban Houston area district by 19 percentage points. Now, Hurd, he was such a treasure because he's a lone black Republican in the House, and now he's retiring. He doesn't like Trump's rhetoric on immigration, and so, you know, that's one of the motivating factors, I think, for him. A lot of times it's just because people, they weren't competitive, they were pretty safe in getting reelected, and now they're not. But here's one stat that might explain some of it. The number of Latinos in Texas has grown by 1.9 million since the 2000 census, which accounts for more than half of the state's growth. So this is a lot. And in Will Hurd's district, 70% of the residents are Latinos. And those people certainly are up for grabs. They can be very conservative, and sometimes their family values can be appealed to by Republicans, but not necessarily. So this is an area where Republicans need to work hard if they want to retain the state. That's what's happening. And, oh, yes, and we've had the Beto O'Rourke phenomenon, which I think may be part of why Ted Cruz is a little worried, because he saw how badly O'Rourke challenged him. But Beto O'Rourke was a phenomenon that's certainly receded since then. Here's a Quinnipiac poll that was released in June. It found that 48% of Texans approved of Trump's job performance, while 49% said they disapproved. That poll also found that Trump is effectively tied in Texas with several of the top contenders in the Democratic race. You know, the polls are not great for Trump right now, and this is a year out. So, you know, the skepticism that we need to have about the polls, I think, is, you know, something we need to think about now. But it's also a reason to be careful, to work hard, and certainly be in prayer if your candidate is in a sense not doing well in the polls. Democrats point to other 2018 contests also as an evidence of an upswing. A couple of U.S. House seats that flipped from red to blue, and a lot of state legislative gains here. So, and here's one more piece of information that might be interesting to you. According to the Texas Tribune, nearly 9 million Texans showed up to the polls in 2016 when Trump won the state by 9 percentage points over Hillary Clinton. So that's an interesting contrast with Mitt Romney in 2012 when he defeated Obama by nearly 16 percentage points here. So Texas is perhaps not up for grabs, but certainly Texans who are concerned about the future need to stay involved, be involved in politics, and make sure that you're watching over what is happening here. We're actually home to the nation's fastest growing cities, so you don't know what type of political leanings of the people that are coming. So that's something to watch, and we will do that. Next up, we'll talk with Sally Pipes about Medicare for All. We'll be back.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
Next week, Congress will reconvene and feel the pressure to do something about guns and gun violence. Some Democratic presidential candidates have proposed a number of federal gun policies. They range from implementing a mandatory government buyback program to requiring every American to obtain a federal license to purchase a firearm. Some call for banning assault weapons. Most call for universal background checks. The members of Congress promoting these various gun policies cite a number of polls that document public frustration with shootings and congressional inaction. But they might want to look deeper into these polls to understand what American voters really feel are appropriate policies. Sometimes Americans tell pollsters they want congressional action but aren't really ready to pay for it. You might remember my commentary last month on climate change. Americans said they want Congress to address this environmental issue, but a majority said they were only willing to spend a dollar a month on the issue. A Pew Research Center study on the demographics of gun ownership found that nearly a majority of American adults live in a household with a firearm. That percentage is even higher for rural Americans. Nearly three-quarters of Americans who own guns said they can't see themselves not owning one. Most proponents of universal background checks argue that they would require a national gun registry. That would be the only way the government could determine if a transaction was made in compliance. How many of those Americans I just mentioned who live in a household with a firearm feel comfortable about having their firearms registered with the federal government? Americans may be calling for congressional action, but I suspect some members of Congress and various candidates have misread what voters would find acceptable. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
From Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers, Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire, rated PG, now playing in theaters. Overcomermovie.com.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Welcome back to Point of View. I'm Penna Dexter, and I was speaking with Congressman Van Taylor earlier in the program. We were talking a little bit about Medicare for All, and he was saying that it polls well until people realize that it doesn't just mean Medicare for All expanded to people that don't have health insurance. It means everybody in the country loses their health insurance and goes on to the government program. And some people aren't quite as excited about that. Well, there are a lot of other problems with Medicare for All. And with me to discuss this is Sally Pipes. She is president and chief executive officer of the Pacific Research Institute, which is based out in San Francisco. It's a think tank. She's also the Thomas W. Smith Fellow in Healthcare Policy at this organization. And she worked in Canada before that, so she knows whereof she speaks. She's the author of The Cure for Obamacare, The Truth About Obamacare, and The Pipes Plan, The Top 10 Ways to Dismantle and Replace Obamacare. Sally, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, healthcare, I believe, is going to be the number one domestic policy issue in the 2020 election. And Medicare for All, a new poll came out from Politico this morning saying that 65% of Democratic voters would be more likely to support Medicare for All than building on Obamacare. So it's a very, very important issue. And, you know, my book that came out last year is The False Promise of Single-Payer Healthcare from Encounter. And now I have a new book coming out in January called False Premise, False Promise, The Disastrous Reality of Medicare for All. So delighted to talk about this subject.
I'm glad that you're here. Do you think in a poll that like the one you cited this morning that people realize what I just mentioned and that Van Taylor mentioned to me today in studio, that people thought it was to take care of the uninsured, but that everybody would have to give up their employer provided health insurance? You wouldn't be able to have any of that. Do people realize that when they're responding to these polls?
Well, I don't think so. And there's a tremendous educational component that needs to be told to the American people about what Medicare for All or single payer means. Because single-payer Medicare for All means there is no private insurance. Everybody is in a government program. And under Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan and Pramila Jayapal, the House member who has a plan, Senator Elizabeth Warren, they believe there should be no private coverage. And it's just all that would be left would be the Veterans Administration, the Indian Health Services, and the rest of us in Medicare for All. Medicare, Medi-Cal, Medicaid would all be rolled into the government plan. The poll that came out in July from Kaiser Family Foundation showed that 51% of the people they polled supported Medicare for all. And that was actually down from 56% back in April, which maybe we're having an impact with our educational programs. But when you ask those same people, well, would you still support it if it meant tax increases, which of course it would, and that support went down to 37%.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they were asked, well, what is your view of it if you would lose your private coverage? And that also went down to 37%. 180 million Americans, as you mentioned, have employer-sponsored coverage. 76% rated as good or excellent. So these people who have employer-sponsored insurance think, as you just mentioned, that this would be for people who are uninsured, not for them. And, of course, what Sanders and Warren and Jayapal and others, or those people like Joe Biden or Cory Booker, who are in the Democratic race for the presidential nomination, what they their public option building on Obamacare, those are also stepping stone approaches to Medicare for all, because a government insurance plan within the exchanges would lead to the crowding out of private coverage. So we really have to let the American people know what this means for them and their insurance.
I think it will be important. They've already tried during the debates to get the candidates to kind of be honest about it, and Kamala Harris has changed her position because of this. She's tried to move back to say, well, my public option will be part of it, but you're not going to lose your insurance. And then, you know, a 10-year sort of ramp up to it being a total single-payer system. How is that going to fly, do you think?
Well, I don't think it is flying at all. I mean, back in earlier this year when she was in Des Moines, Iowa, for a CNN debate, she, of course, as you say, she came out and strongly, yes, when she was asked, yes, I support single payer. Let's eliminate all of that, i.e. private insurance. And then the next day, she said, well, after some pushback, you know, she was changing her mind. In the debate, she was one of the four people, in the first debate, the four people who put up their hand for supporting single payer, along with, you know, Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, New York Mayor de Blasio, and herself. And then later that day, she said, well, I didn't understand the question. And then she was in Iowa last week, and she was at an old people's home, and one of the, talking about her plan, and one of the 91-year-old people who lived in this retirement home said, you know, leave my health care alone. And she was left speechless. But I think the reason she is dropping like a stone in the polls is because she doesn't know, she can't articulate where she really fits. I think she does believe in single payer Medicare for all, but she's backtracked a bit, as you mentioned, on this, on her sort of stepping stone 10-year approach to Medicare for all, where the wealthy would be paying for, you know, a public option. And of course, there'd be new taxes on people who own stocks and bonds and derivatives and things, which she thinks they'd raise about $2 billion over 10 years, which is nothing compared to what Bernie Sanders has even finally admitted, that his healthcare plan would cost between $30 and $40 trillion over 10 years. And that's what Charles Blayhouse at Mercatus had estimated on his 2017 bill and his 2019 bill. And of course, this would all mean much higher taxes, new taxes, a shortage of doctors, because when under these plans, doctors are going to be paid 40% below what they get paid for treating private patients, because they'd be tied to Medicare rates. And then, of course, there would be long waits for care, and care would be rationed.
Well, that's your article that we've posted, ladies and gentlemen, at pointofview.net. Medicare care for all would be hazardous to the health of seniors, and I guess the lady at that senior living center in Iowa knew that. She got it. She gets it. And I think a lot of seniors do. We like, you know, America as a whole likes Medicare. But first of all, Medicare for the whole country just doesn't work because of what you just said. Doctors are not paid really what they need to be paid. It's sort of financed by those with private insurance. And if you don't have anybody with private insurance, you've got a problem, don't you?
Well, absolutely. And Pramila Jayapal, who wants her, who, if the Democrats took over the presidency and took the Senate back and held the House, she has admitted that 1 million people who work in the health insurance industry would lose their jobs. So this would be a huge expansion for government. But, you know, in terms of employment, but, you know, people don't like the DMV. They don't like the post office. They like having options of different things. But I was at my own doctor last Friday having my annual checkup at my OBGYN, and he started, he knows I work a lot in the healthcare space. He's not political. But he said, you know, I lose money on the Medi-Cal patients. That's the California version of Medicaid. I don't make any money on Medicare patients. So my I'm paid by the people who have private insurance. And if we got Medicare for all, I would retire immediately, as would the members of my team who, you know, the breast cancer surgeons, the medical oncologists, because we couldn't afford to stay. And the worst, I think, is that, you know, America's best and brightest kids are the ones who apply to medical school, and they've traditionally become doctors. But if doctors, if medical students see that they're going to become union members, the best and brightest will not go into medicine. They will be paid not according to merit and how good they are, but just according to a government fee schedule. I mean, this is going to be a disaster and will lead, like it does in Canada, to a shortage of doctors. And where today in Canada, the average wait from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist is just under 5 months. Canada outlaws any form of private coverage that for anything considered medically necessary. And yet you have people like Bernie Sanders coming up. The Canadian healthcare system is fantastic. He never talks about the long waits. The elderly have their care rationed, as in the case of my own mother. And the fact that the Fraser Institute's new study came out and said that an average Canadian family of four is paying $13,311 a year in hidden taxes for a healthcare system that rations care, puts them on a waiting list, and the fact that 215,000 Canadians out of a population of 37 million cross the border into the U.S. and pay for tests and surgeries, that they feel the waiting time is just too long.
If you have a question about Medicare for All for Sally Pipes, give us a call, 800-351-1212. It would be, as she says, hazardous to the health of seniors. And we're going to talk about ration care and how that will be absolutely necessary under that system. We'll be back.
From Affirm Films, Provident Films, and the Kindred Brothers comes Overcomer. John Harrison is a frustrated coach questioning his value until he crosses paths with a student struggling on her own journey.
What have you allowed to define you? When you find your identity, the one who created you, it'll change your whole perspective.
Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shirer. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Now play. More information is available at overcomermovie.com.
It's been said that a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. That was definitely true in the 19th century when preacher Charles Spurgeon said it. But here in the 21st century, truth can be just as fast. Think about it. When Point of View presents the truth, it reaches people across America and around the world instantly. You make that instant truth a reality when you join the Point of View Radio Truth Team. Get all the details now at pointofview.net/team or call 800-347-5151. pointofview.net/team and 800-347-5151.
Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Pina Dexter.
Wow, ladies and gentlemen, the phones are full. The lines lit up, and people want to talk about this issue of Medicare for All. Sally Pipes is my guest, and she knows what she's talking about because she's worked in the field, and she's also headed up a think tank in Canada about health care. And then, Sally, you mentioned also that your mom was in Canada and experienced their system, and it was pretty negative. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. So I'm Canadian. I'm now an American, but I grew up in Canada, worked at the Fraser Institute for my career before I moved to the U.S. to take over Pacific Research. But back in 2005, my mother, who was a senior, thought that she might have colon cancer. And so she went to her general practitioner, primary care doctor, who then suggested, who ordered an X-ray for her. And of course, for those people who are familiar with colon cancer, you don't detect it with an X-ray. You have to have a colonoscopy. So I told her to call back and get a colonoscopy scheduled. And she was told by her doctor that she couldn't get a colonoscopy because there were too many younger people who weren't seniors who were on the waiting list trying to get colonoscopies and who had symptoms. So she didn't get her colonoscopy. That was in July. By late September, she had lost weight. And then in November, she called me and said she was hemorrhaging. And so she went to the hospital, Vancouver General, in an ambulance and waited and spent 2 days in the emergency room, 2 days in the transit lounge waiting for a bed in a ward. She got her colonoscopy and died 2 weeks later from metastasized colon cancer. It is so much cheaper. Government has to, has so many things to fund that they have to limit what they spend on healthcare. Canada spends about 11% of its gross domestic product on healthcare. We spend about 18% in this country. It's a lot, but we are a wealthy country and people demand the best. So,
and we don't even have a single payer system like they have.
No,
we're already
exactly.
spending more than them.
Right. So the thing is, the government has to ration, doctors' care has to be rationed because, there's not enough money to go around for all of the latest in equipment, MRI machines, PET machines. Canada ranks very low in the OECD ratings in terms of per capita per million on MRI machines, CT scans, PET scanners, things like that. So anyway, when government determines how much they're going to spend, the older people get their care rationed, and that would happen here. We have an example in this country of a single-payer system, and it's the Veterans Administration. And for those people who follow the mainstream media, the VA has been under severe attack over the last couple of years because vets have been denied the latest drugs, getting into the hospital. The waiting times have been long. They're trying to make some changes. But that is a single-payer system, and the federal government determines, how much money is going to be spent on the VA and what kind of care patients are going to get. The United Kingdom is another example. The National Health Service, which was started in 1947, a single-payer system, but the NHS the British government allowed private care to run parallel, and about 10% of Brits actually have private health care. But 4 million Brits were waiting in May on waiting lists trying to get appointments with doctors because the NHS system, they can't put enough money into it. There's a doctor shortage. And if you remember earlier this year when Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones mm-hmm. was diagnosed with a heart problem, he didn't fly back to Britain and have his surgery under an NHS hospital. He had it done at, the very famous New York Presbyterian. And his younger brother said, thank goodness Mick didn't have to, come back to the UK and get his surgery under the National Health Service. So Canadians, as I said, 215,000 Canadians cross the border to get treatments where they think the waiting time is too long. The singer Michael Bublé, who is Canadian, who lives in Vancouver, where I'm from, when his little son, age three, Noah, was diagnosed with liver cancer at age three, he didn't wait around in Vancouver to try and get an appointment or try and get the latest treatment. He went to UCLA and had his son treated there, and he's still, alive today and doing well. And of course, yes, he could afford to come to UCLA, but it's interesting that he chose the American system where the latest treatments are available.
We're taking calls. We've got all these calls waiting for you, Sally. I'm hoping that you can stick with me for another segment after this one because we have so many calls. Can you?
I could stay till about 5 to 12.
Okay, perfect.
Which I'm on. It's 20 to 12 right now.
Okay, great. Thank you. That will help me a lot. I wanted to also ask you about seniors because you wrote about this in the article that we posted. And we have so many wonderful things now to make our lives better. And as you grow older, these things to take advantage of, cataract surgeries, hip replacements, knee replacements, and, just so many things now that we take for granted that we can get. And the colonoscopy, they beg us to have our colonoscopies here. So all of this, this would not be the situation under a Medicare for all single payer system. We would not have all of this so readily available, would we?
No. Well, if you look at the UK, under the National Health Service, they just said that, you know, cataract surgeries, they were, you know, not going to be doing cataract surgeries for people on a regular basis because it wasn't in the interest of our public health. Well, you know, all of these things in Britain, they've just announced recently that it would be the National Health Service could reduce waiting times for people if they did group appointments. And so therefore, appointments of people with similar complaints, 15 people at a time, could, you know, be part of one group. In Canada, you're only allowed to, when you book your appointment with your primary care doctor or GP, of course, you can't book with a specialist. You have to first go through a general practitioner. And of course, Bernie Sanders said we'd have no referrals in this country. Well, think about it. If there were no referrals and everybody was just calling specialists all the time, the demand would be so great, and supply would not be there. But in Canada, so when you, if you had two or three ailments that you thought you wanted to see the doctor about, you would only be able to book your appointment for one issue. If you have a second issue to talk about, you have to book a second appointment. And each appointment can only be 15 minutes. This is what happens when government has to control the cost of healthcare and the provision of healthcare.
Okay, let's go to the phones, Sally. We've got people that want to ask you questions. Matthew is in Arkansas. Hi, Matthew. Thank you for calling. You're on with Sally Pipes.
Oh, fantastic. It's such a political cliche that I hear coming from the radio, and it sounds like it's the same talking points that I've heard over and over again. What's wrong with this system? And point out what's bad about it. Tell me how to fix it. I have a copay.
I'm sure Sally has many ideas about how to fix it.
I have a copay. I have a deductible. I have a $5,000 deductible. You understand that? That is a lot of money. Now, I'm sure I can see the hesitancy of wanting to have Medicare for all. But what is the solution short term? Because I don't think private care is going to be the all-be fix-all.
Sally.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure whether you're on an exchange plan in Arkansas or whether you have employer-sponsored coverage. Certainly, under Obamacare, only 10.7 million people are in the exchanges. Even a Democratic congresswoman from Massachusetts just came out recently and said, you know, she has an exchange plan and it is not good. She's, you know, she said the congressional staffers have much better health care than the members of Congress. But under Obamacare, of course, the average premium, you know, is about, in the exchanges, is about, for people without subsidies, is about $600 a month. And the premium, the average deductibles are, you know, $5,000 to $6,000, and people can't afford to use their exchange coverage. So, you know, Obamacare was introduced as a way to achieve universal coverage and bend the cost curve down. Remember, Obama promised a $2,500 reduction in premiums for the average family. That did not happen at all. We overturned our healthcare system for about 10.8 million people. But what we need to do is, for those people who have employer-based coverage, they get their coverage tax-free. But for those people who are in the individual market, they have to buy their coverage with after-tax dollars. What we need are universal choice will lead to universal coverage. Your caller, I mean, I don't know what age group he's in, whether he's, as I say, in individual market, in the group market through his employer. But, you know, people, young people found the under Obamacare, young people were supposed to, you know, buy exchange coverage in order to subsidize older people who had chronic conditions and who went to the doctor more. But it turned out young people decided they'd pay that individual mandate fine of $695 or 2.5% of income because it was cheaper than buying a premium, and they are the invincibles. They wouldn't get sick. And so, therefore, premiums for exchange people went up significantly. We've got rid of the individual mandate under President Trump, the executive order allowing for short-term limited duration plans where you could buy coverage in the individual market for 12 months and renew it up to 3 years. This is a great, these are great things that happen, but we need more choices for
people.
Yeah,
we need more choices.
We need more competition. We need more competition.
And we'll be right back.
That will bring...
We'll be right back.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
My guest is Sally Pipes. We are talking about Medicare for All, and we're taking your calls. Diane is in South Carolina, listening in on WAGP. Hi, Diane. What's your question for Sally Pipes?
Hi. I have a granddaughter who's 12, and she's had diabetes type 1 for a year or a little more, and she's on a pump, and her father's insurance is great right now. It covers all of her doctor's appointments and supplies and anything needed. Her mom doesn't have to worry about that, just take care of her daughter. So what would happen with that?
What would happen with diabetes, Sally?
Oh, you mean under a Medicare for All
yes.
system? Well, first of all,
yes.
You know, a lot of the latest innovations in diabetes, most of the innovations in pharmaceuticals and biologics and all of these things happen in the United States. They don't happen in Canada or Britain because those countries have price controls and therefore there's no incentive to do the work. And it costs about $2.5 billion from an idea to get a drug or biologic through all the trials and through the FDA approval process. So, you know, whatever the illness is, whether it's cancer, diabetes, you know, we want to keep the market open so that we can continue to be the leader in the world of the latest treatments. Because your granddaughter, obviously her father has good coverage and she's getting the best. In other countries, you know, like a lot of the treatments that are available aren't even the latest treatments because, say, in Canada, the Therapeutic Practices Prices Review Board decides what drugs and treatments are affordable. And so many of the latest things don't even get onto the formularies because they're not affordable. And so therefore, Canadians are denied the latest treatment. So we want to keep our healthcare system open, competitive, choice, and keep things like research and development open because this is where the latest treatments are developed, and it's so important for everyone in our country.
Sally, I'm going to let you go on time. It's in a couple minutes. I'll probably try to get to one more call here, but I just wanted to say thank you for joining us today and for this work. It's I do think it is the issue of the moment, and our country could go one way or another. It's going to affect everything, including our economy, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, as I say, I mean, even Charles Blayhouse came out and said that the 30 to 40 trillion over 10 years is probably low because a lot of doctors will retire because they're going to be paid these lower rates, and the demand for healthcare, people think something's free, you know, will be a lot greater than the supply.
Okay, this is a call from Steve. Steve, make it quick because Sally has to give you a short answer too.
Appreciate your topic. I'm a retired military. I got TRICARE. I find that TRICARE is not as good as the VA. Because VA just seems to be under a lot more pressure to do a better job. But my question is medical sharing groups. There's one, won't mention the name on the radio because you may advertise for them, that talk about medical sharing. Mm-hmm. It's not healthcare. What do you think of it?
Sally?
No, I think medical sharing is a great idea, and a number of the ministries have it, and it works well for smaller groups. This is what I say. We need more competition. We need... You know, we need short-term limited duration plans. We need small employers to group together to offer association health plans. We need ministries. We need PPOs, HMOs. This is what makes America great. We need all kinds of different types so that people can choose the type of healthcare system that works for them and their families. And sharing ministries and these things like that are an option, and people should be able to have them and use them.
Sally, thank you so much for joining us today. You're a wealth of information. I hope you'll come back. I think we're going to need you during this debate.
Good. Well, I'd love to, and thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Sally Pipes. She's with Pacific Research Institute. Let's continue to take your calls on this issue. Yes, the sharing plans, I will say, people have been able to do those under Obamacare, and I hope they continue. Don't know what will happen under Medicare for All, though. We'll just have to see. Let's go to Annette in Georgia. Hi, Annette. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I think I have more of a comment. I just hope, you know, so much that our government you know, not turn out to have Medicare for all, because I had was in a similar experience of having in a program called W80, W81, maybe about some quite a few years ago, and it was run by the government. And then I noticed when you got serious illness, serious sickness, when it come down to your bones or different ailments in your body, they only do x-rays when you may need an MRI. And then every time you got to go get your checkup to see how things going, you got different doctors and they write their different opinions. And then many times you have to be on the waiting list and you're just not going to get the care that you need when you have your PPO or maybe HMO right now.
Was this a Medicaid? Was this a Medicaid program?
Medicaid, because at that time, by you not being pregnant or having a child, in this particular place, you couldn't get Medicaid. So they put you on a program called, you got to be out of work for a year, and they put you on a program called W80, W81. It's okay, and it's pretty good for people who don't have the income. You get your medication, but you does not get your directly treatment, what you really need. You get more medicated than you would getting down to you know, your situation, what you need, and they doesn't give you an MRI if you might need it.
MRIs are such a great diagnostic tool, so that, and they're, but they're expensive, so you can see that that may be squeezed out under this single payer. Listen, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Let's go now to the state of Nevada and speak with Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie, you're on Point of View real quick.
Hi, I'm basically an advocate for definitely no Medicare for all.
You don't like it, or you do?
I definitely don't like it. I am unfortunately on Medicaid due to circumstances beyond my control, crazy car accident 6.5 years ago. And I have been routed and rerouted. We have a diagnosis for me, and my insurance company, which is Medicaid, is basically refusing to acknowledge that I need life-saving surgery. My collarbone, shoulder blade, and rib cage were all knocked out of place, so I have everything from brain stem problems all the way to my innards not working, my body not processing food, et cetera. And
this is, you're fighting Medicaid now.
And I'm fighting Medicaid. So yesterday, I mean, I
got
the governor's office involved.
I hate to do this because I wanted to hear the rest, but we're just about up on a hard break, and I won't be able to. But
that's fine. I
think
hold.
You made the best point, though, I think, is that it's just you're giving us a personal experience of government health care and how frustrating it can be. And there's certainly not one-size-fits-all solution, but there are solutions, and there are smart people out there. And Medicare for all, we can already see the numbers don't work well. And that it's not going to be an improvement. In fact, it's going to probably destroy our healthcare system and our economy. We will continue that discussion over the months. But next up, we've got a guest coming in to talk about special needs adoption. You won't want to miss it. Stay with us for more of Point of View.
Point of View is committed to spreading the truth, oftentimes a truth that those in political power don't like getting heard. But the only way it can be heard is if our team stands strong together, if everyone, if you do what you can to support the Point of View Truth Team. It's having an impact, as we heard recently from U.S. Representative Louis Gohmert.
Everywhere I go, I hear people that you have influenced, that Point of View has affected. You have made such a difference, and you rely on people to contribute, And if they don't contribute, then that truth does not get heard.
Help Point of View make a difference. Pray and consider what level is right for you. $30, $65, $100 a month, or even more. Please do what you can. 1-800-347-5151 or visit online pointofview.net. Look near the top right for the link that says Become a Monthly Partner. Join the Truth Team. 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net. Point of View will continue after this.
Across America, live, this is Point of View. And now, Pina Dexter.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for sticking with us here on Point of View. In the next couple of segments, I have a very interesting guest. But after that, Carrie Lucas will join us. She's president of the Independent Women's Forum, talking about her pamphlet, Checking Progressive Privilege. You know, we've got male privilege, white privilege, but we don't really think about progressive privilege. The progressive worldview is really what is quote-unquote normal. And we need to be aware of that, sort of a handicap for conservatives. But right now, I am so excited to introduce my next guest. I met her at a breakfast in Washington, D.C., and I found out about an organization that she is developing and is actually on board now. Our guest is Lori Roman, and Lori has been a leader in some very cool organizations. For instance, she was executive director of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a powerful organization. She was also director, chief of staff of the White House Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives at the Department of Education. I could list a lot, but I'm instead going to introduce her. She is Lori Roman. Lori, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Penna. I am so happy to be with you, and thank you for having me on. It's great to talk to you.
I know you have a new job you're starting. We're not talking about this today, but it's with the ACRU, the American Civil Rights Union, right? You're starting soon? You already started?
Yes, I have already started. So I'm running two organizations at the same time. And American Civil Rights Union is a fantastic organization that defends the civil rights of all Americans and defends the Constitution from, as I like to say, from the border to the ballot box.
We will have you on about that. But today we're going to talk about the Ann Children's Fund. I was so intrigued when you told me about it, Lori, and really it has to do, and I know that we talked a lot today about the sanctity of human life, and to add to that, I mean, you can talk about opposing abortion, but adopting children is another way to uphold the sanctity of life. And so you saw a special need in the midst of that, and that is people that adopt special needs kids. They've got some special needs themselves. Sometimes you end up with unexpected issues and things you come up against, and you really need some help, and that's what you're there for, isn't it?
Right. Well, the Ann Children's Fund is truly a labor of love for me, and it is named after my mom, Ann, and today is actually the 31st anniversary of her passing, and so it is how I'm carrying on her legacy of helping children. I grew up in a family. I was blessed to have amazing parents who were just wonderful examples of living out their faith quietly. They didn't lecture and they didn't preach, but they lived every single day the way anyone would hope that parents would live. But my mom was a Girl Scout troop leader for Down syndrome girls when I was younger. She took me everywhere with her. And we also had a Braille typewriter always at the end of our dining room table because she, long before computers, translated children's books into Braille for children in our area. And she was just a wonderful example of helping people, helping children, helping anyone who needed help. And this is how I plan to carry on her legacy for the rest of my life. So in addition to whatever else I'm doing, whether it's ACRU or anything else, This is an important part of my life, and I've been joined by wonderful friends who have come alongside me to volunteer with me to do this, and also an amazing and wonderful husband who was very understanding when I explained that God had laid this on my heart and it was going to take some money. And so, as always, he just says, okay, honey, just tell me what you need us to do. Mm. And so I'm very blessed in that regard.
Well, tell us about how this organization, so what's your plan for the AND Fund? You've got a unique plan.
Well, this year we obtained our 501c3 status with the IRS, so we are official. And there are two core ideas with the AND Children's Fund, and it is overall to provide hope and help to children and families who have children with special needs or are seriously ill. So they have adopted them, the children are seriously ill, or they have a serious medical need, and we want to come alongside them and provide hope for them and to show them that they're not alone. It's a huge undertaking. So we do that in two ways. We have a Helping Hands Resource Center that is to connect families to a network of organizations that can cater to their specific needs. So we didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We know there are many resources out there, and part of our job is to help adoptive parents find the resources they need. So whether it's a camp for their children or whether it's special medical needs or specialists, we have a wonderful person, Laura, on our staff, who's a resource director, and she has made herself an expert on these resources. So step one is if someone reaches out to us, we see if there's another organization that can meet their need so that we're not reinventing the wheel, and we try to connect them. We don't necessarily endorse the other organizations, but we do learn about them and make sure that we understand what they offer so we can connect people. And then the second thing is if we can't connect them and we can't meet their need in that way through that resource center, we seek to provide meaningful, quantifiable assistance to these adoptive families based on their need. And one of the most important things I noticed when we decided we wanted to reach out to help adoptive families like this, was that there are a lot of places that will help families with some area that the organization has already decided they're going to supply. For instance, they may supply hearing aids or they may supply wheelchairs. But we weren't really finding many organizations that would say, tell us what you need. Come to us and tell us what you need, because some of the needs are so unique.
Yeah.
And they change throughout the child's life and throughout their treatment plans. And so we wanted to be a place that was warm and friendly, where people could call us and say, this is our family, here are our needs, and this is the specific need we have right now, and we try to meet it. Even this week, we have an amazing family that we're helping this week. You can see them on andfund.org is our website, ANNFUND.org. Is the website. But if you go to that website, you can see this amazing and wonderful family. They've adopted children, and this week we're trying to help Aina, who has spina bifida, and her brother Easton, who has osteogenesis imperfecta. I hope I'm saying that correctly. But they are both in wheelchairs, and they have some very specific therapy needs. And at the moment, we're raising money to help them with a therapy bike. An adaptive bike.
So you're finding, I've got to jump in because we're about on a break, but you're finding the need and you're meeting that specific need. So you are not meeting a need that they don't have. You're meeting a need they do have. Ladies and gentlemen, you can go to pointofview.net. You can see Lori's picture and click through to her website, andfund.org, to find out more. And I would remember this this website, because you're going to run into people that will want to go there and take advantage of it. We've got more. I've got more questions for Lori Roman. And if you have one, give us a call, 800-351-1212. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Welcome back to Point of View. I'm Penna Dexter, and we are talking about adoption of children with special needs. And parents who adopt a child or children with special needs are heroes. They have to count the cost. And, of course, you can never count all of the costs because things are going to come up. You may think your insurance company will cover everything or a lot of it, and then something comes up that is not covered. And there's just so much to it. And so to have an organization like the Ann Fund that comes alongside is wonderful. And Lori Roman is my guest. She has created and begun this organization. She's brought alongside with her some talented people. One of them, Carrie. I realized yesterday, Lori, that Carrie was the Carrie that used to come in to Point of View when she lived in Dallas and co-host with me on the show back in the, I think, the early 2000s, maybe even the late 90s. And I know for a fact she's a talented administrator, so it's going to be a good experience for you. I know you're good friends with her, that she's part of your organization. So that was a nice surprise for me.
Yes, but there's more to that story. Not only is Carrie a wonderful friend and a fantastic person of faith and a leader in public policy, but Carrie is adopted, and her adoptive mother's name is Anne.
I love it.
So, and Laura on our team, and we're all volunteers. No one's taking a salary. Laura on our team is a longtime colleague and friend, and she has adopted three children with special medical needs. And her mother's name was Anne, and her little girl, who is adopted with special needs from China, is named after her mother, who is Anne. So the whole team has Anne stories. We mm-hmm. all have adoption stories. My two grandsons are adopted, and I helped my son with their adoptions to rescue them from foster care. So all three of us have adoption stories. All three of us have Anne stories. And we really feel that God has a plan for this organization. We consider it a ministry. All of our hearts are into it. We all have other things we do. But this is a labor of love that is very, very close to our hearts.
Well, there's something about that, the name Anne, and it's a very special name. And I sense that the Lord is really moving through this. I love hearing the story, Lori. Lori, just talk a little bit about the people that you've met who are in need, who are heroes adopting children. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know some stories of what they've gone through. They've obviously got to be great and giving people, but none of us can anticipate what we might face when we adopt a child that's got special needs, can we?
Well, it's true. And because there are over 100 million people in this country who have adoption in their immediate family, that means a lot of the people who are listening to you right now, this is also near and dear to their hearts. They also have their own adoption stories. So you have to probably figure 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 of your listeners probably have an adoption story. Probably 1 in 3, because the Christian community and so many churches, it is considered a ministry. And so many churches have done a wonderful job of making foster care and adoption part of their ministry. So I'm going to guess even more than that in your listening audience, this is important to them. And in addition to that, you have many grandparents who have taken on adopting children as their children have had problems with opioid addiction and mm-hmm. other problems. There's just so many grandparents out there, probably in your listening audience, who are right now caring for special needs children. And our prayer always is that our donations exceed our requests for help, and because the need is so great. And then they willingly take this on out of love. And we know that raising a child with special medical needs costs about 4 times more than raising a child without special medical needs. So their needs are great. Special therapies, as you mentioned, a lot of it's not covered by insurance. Some things are not covered at all. Some things, there's a large copay. There are parents out there who take on these children, and then they find out that the specialist they need is across the country, and some parents move their entire families to be closer to the specialist. There aren't currently places other than us that I know of, maybe there are, where people can get help with some of those travel needs or some of the hotel bills to get to a specialist that they need. That is one of those needs that people often don't think about. The start of the whole story, though, and the night that God laid this whole idea on my heart was early this year when Laura from our team, who I worked with at another organization, I was praying for her and her three children who I had helped her along the way navigate some of the ins and outs of the adoption of her children who have special medical needs. And I was praying for her that night because we were both about to lose our jobs. Our organization was closing. And I had to tell Laura, who worked on my staff at the time, I was going to have to tell Laura that she was about to lose her medical insurance. And this was something none of us anticipated. We didn't know our organization was going to close that we worked for. And I had such a burden for her and her children. And I thought to myself, what happens when amazing people like Laura, and Laura's a single mom who's taken on three children with very specific medical needs, what happens when something unexpected like this comes up? Where do you go for help when maybe you need some help with COBRA insurance as a stopgap for a few months in between jobs? And that was the night when I was praying for Laura that I realized there was a need that perhaps wasn't being met. I was thinking about, it was the same time there was a lot in the news about late-term abortions. It was the same week that I was in the news, and I was thinking to myself about how wonderful it was that people like Laura are willing to adopt, because so many of those children who are victims of late-term abortion, it's because their medical need was diagnosed in the womb, and because of that, they were aborted. So I had a burden also on the life side of it. I was thinking about my mom, and it all came about because of Laura, who's now a volunteer and working on this with me. What she's done for these three children is exceptional and amazing, and we need to come around people like her and help. You know, people always, a lot of times, I started my public policy career working on assisted suicide and pro-life issues, and I often heard people say, conservatives only care about babies in the womb. They don't care about them after they're born, and we know that's not true. How many churches and how many people do you know in the Christian community in particular take care and focus on adoption and foster care? We know it's not true.
Yeah, we know it's not true.
But it is, it's an accusation that's often made. But we know there are people like Laura and people like the parents of these two precious little children who we're working on with the adaptive bike this week. They're there. They have amazing hearts and love. And, you know, 50% of the adoptive parents, especially kids, are single parents.
I did not know
single parents.
You know, Lori, we're almost on a break here. Actually, the end of the half hour, and it's gone kind of fast. But I just kind of want to say something about faith, because I see your faith and your Laura that you are mentioning. I mean, the amount of faith that she had to have to take on three special needs children as a single mom. And, I mean, she's just an example of many. So it's taking a step of doing something that is impossible, but knowing that God will show up. And I think, in a sense, Ann Fund is an organization that has done that same thing on a different level, taken a step of faith. God has to show up through a lot of other people that are going to come in and make donations and help. But you just took it and you pulled it together because God has given you those skills and experience. And so I'm so grateful for you. And I want you to just here in the last moment, just tell us again how people can find out more about you, whether they're in need or whether they want to help.
Well, thank you. On the web, they can go to annfund.org, annfund.org, and donate online. Certainly, we need people who come alongside us as monthly donors or one-time donors who are willing to help. Laura and Carrie and I have committed to not take any salaries at this point, and they can know that their money is going directly to helping children.
And right.
We have covered most of our startup costs for the year, and we're focused on helping families at this point. They can also go to Ann Children's Fund on Facebook. You can't donate through Facebook. You're eventually going to have to go to the okay. Website to do that. But pray for us, please. Pray for us and for the families.
Laura, thank you so much for joining me today. And just God bless you. This is a wonderful work. We'll be back.
We live in a digital generation. Point of View is reaching this often overly plugged-in generation with truth. You can keep up with us 24 hours a day using your phone, your tablet, your laptop, or your desktop. Search for the Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, where you can keep up with today's issues, learn about current and upcoming guests by liking us on Facebook. Also, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Point of View RTS. That stands for Point of View Radio Talk Show. Learn, interact, make a difference with Point of View using new media. And here's one way you can make a big difference. Help us increase our reach by spreading the word among your friends. Share a Facebook post. Tag us in a tweet. With enough joining us to plant seeds, we'll see a tremendous harvest. Come on, it only takes a minute. Search for Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, at Point of View RTS on Twitter, and subscribe to the Point of View Radio Talk Show channel on YouTube. Learn, interact, share. The Point of View Radio Talk Show. Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Pina Dexter.
Welcome back to Point of View. A little bit earlier, we were speaking with Sally Pipes, who was talking to us from San Francisco. That's where she's got her think tank. And I came across something by Cal Thomas, famous columnist, conservative, on the Daily Signal about San Francisco that I thought was kind of interesting. It's entitled, "They've Lost Their Minds in San Francisco." And certainly, and I was just there recently, not actually in the city, but outside San Francisco. So beautiful. It's a city described for its natural beauty. But it's descending into an abyss of homelessness, as you've probably heard in the news. And, you know, things like, as Cal Thomas said, the use of sidewalks as toilets. Pretty gross. That's why I didn't go into the city when I was out there. Didn't want to be near all that. But there's a new demonstration of insanity coming out of that city and their board of supervisors, and they've adopted a new set of language guidelines called Person First. These are meant to change the public's perception of criminals, and so they've changed some wording. If no longer are you to use the words convicted felon, offender, convict, or addict, or juvenile delinquent, they're out. Now you are to refer to these types of individuals as a justice-involved person. And if someone has been called a criminal, they are not called that anymore. They're now referred to as a returning resident or a formerly incarcerated person. So, you know, as in many areas, they're changing the language. And, you know, in a sense, I think this may be an example, and I'll ask our next guest if it's an example of what she has written about, which is progressive privilege, a little book pamphlet, one of these encounter broadside pamphlets called Checking Progressive Privilege. And as I mentioned, one form of privilege that's been overlooked is progressive privilege. It's the progressive worldview that's depicted really what is normal, right, and worth celebrating by our cultural institutions. With me to talk about it is the author. Her name is Carrie Lucas, and she is president of the Independent Women's Forum, which is a great organization. She's been there at that organization since 2003. Before that, she worked on Capitol Hill for the House Republican Policy Center or Committee. She also worked for Cato Institute, but now she writes for publications like the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, USA Today, New York Post, and others. And Carrie, I'm so glad to have you with me. This little booklet was very informative and interesting. Why did you think it was necessary to write it?
Thank you. You know, I think that so many of us on the right have for a long time kind of gotten frustrated with what we see as liberal media bias. And we're often pointing out, this is the newspaper's cover thing in a slanted way. They choose terrible pictures of conservatives. We all know all the ways that they tilt the playing field in favor of Democratic politicians. But I started kind of looking around and realizing that, as you were just alluding to, that this is really not just about news story. It's really about a culture and defining what's normal. And it occurred to me that it was very much akin to what we know has traditionally happened when it comes to these concept of privileges and what it is to be a majority and what it is to kind of be considered this is what's normal, this is kind of the default. And today, you know, obviously there was a legacy, and I look back at kind of the concept of white privilege and male privilege. But today, while I think we've made a lot of progress on white privilege and male privilege, and that's no longer nearly as pervasive, it's progressive privilege that I really think is a dominant force in our culture.
But people don't really recognize it or define it. So let's define it. You say it's the privilege afforded to the progressive worldview by many of the most influential institutions of our society. So we know that there's a progressive sort of slant in the media. We know academia is famous for that. So what else? What else?
Well, yeah, I think it's almost helpful. I found it helpful when I was writing this book to look back and kind of look at just isolate that concept of privilege a little bit, because it's in recent years we now see so many ridiculous manifestations of privilege, or the conversation around privilege has become so crazy on college campuses. But I looked back at when in 1988 when this a woman began writing and brought up this idea of and defined white privilege. It was actually I felt very convincing. I mean, she basically looked at her every day. She was a white woman, and she looked at all the ways that that she had kind of these what she can describe as unearned benefits. The fact that when she opened a magazine, most of the people she saw were from her race. If she looked at her kids' textbook, most of it came from culture. Things like that very much just, she picked out a color of Band-Aid, and the default color was going to be something that was at least sort of close to her own skin color. I think that this is that kind of, we saw that back in the 1980s. Obviously, we were much less diverse then, than we are today. But that's how I think when you start looking around at the TV shows, at if you open a magazine and even the textbooks of our kids' curriculums, that's where you'll see all these different ways that that progressive privilege now exists.
So why is it important to recognize it? We don't recognize it. You're right, and that's why I'm glad you wrote this Encounter Broadside about it. This is so readable because you can do it in one sitting. I love these.
Yeah.
But, it's harmful not to recognize it. It's beneficial, especially not just for conservatives. It's beneficial for everyone if we recognize that this privilege exists, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny. I tried to write this book with the idea that I didn't want it just to be an argument for those of us who are on the right to say, yes, I see this. But I was hopeful that we could at least put it in the context of we know that when you treat people, when you marginalize people, whether it's whether it was historically non-whites, or whether it was when it was just heterosexuals that had privilege, when it's men, we know that it's unfair to those to the people who are being excluded or who are being marginalized. But it's also bad for other people. You miss out on a whole part of information and perspectives and kind of just a diversity of life when you start looking at other people's perspectives. And that's absolutely what's going on when it comes to political ideology today. It's funny. I went to I went to graduate school at Harvard University. I got my master's there. And one thing that I said was, I was among the only non leftists there, and you know, there was very few that would have at all considered themselves Republicans, certainly none that were kind of committed conservatives or libertarians. And I remember thinking to myself what a tremendous disservice it was to the people on the left there in the room, because they were not, you know, they were patting themselves on the back. They were not being exposed to the best arguments of the right. There was only, you know, I was really the only person who was going to stand up and try to push back. But, you know, I was just a student. It's silly. Like, I was, you know, I was getting this great education and being challenged. Anything I believed was being really pushed, and I had to learn how to defend myself, learn how to answer their arguments, come up with better data points. But the left didn't get that. And I think that's when you think about it in the, you know, you kind of blow that up, and you see how that happens on a macro scale in our country. You absolutely see that happening. And, you know, weaker Democratic ideas and then Democratic candidates get in because the media is there applauding them. The, you know, academia is there applauding. They're very rarely vetted in the way that the Republicans are. And so I do think it's making their party weaker. You know, it hurts conservatives, certainly, but it also makes the left weaker than it needs to be and less, kind of less sharp, less disciplined. And they would be better off if they had a little bit more of that.
I think your book is timely because it's really playing out on the Democratic debate stage right now. But among these candidates, I mean, their ideas are so out there. And, you know, they cannot be, I mean, I just don't think in the long run they can really be sold to the American public.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, and it's funny. I think we all kind of get a sense of this. You know, and obviously, you know, we've become in such a hyper-partisan moment, and I do think that I hope that Democrats will also consider, you know, for so long, conservatives felt as though that we were always being demonized, and I felt this, that you got kind of used to just being thought of, you know, having to have slurs. You know, you're often called racist, you're mm-hmm. called, you know, a self-hating woman if you're a conservative. You hear a lot of this and you see yourself kind of denigrated, and it's frustrating. It's demoralizing. And I think that when the left is so shocked by the appeal of Donald Trump, you know, why would somebody, you know, he's vulgar, he says all these terrible things, uses bad language. But I think that one thing they didn't understand or couldn't sympathize with was that for a lot of conservatives out there, just the fact that Donald Trump said, you know, I'm not going to take it, and was willing to push back and say, you know, forget you, media, that was so, you know, refreshing and so kind of empowering to a lot of people. That's one reason why, if people don't understand how, you know, Donald Trump became president, well, progressive privilege is a big part of it.
I think so. Hey, we've got more on this topic in just a minute. We've got a break. But folks, call in if you want to talk to Carrie about this. 800-351-1212. We'll be back.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
My guest is Carrie Lucas. She is the president of the Independent Women's Forum, and we're talking about her Encounter Broadside pamphlet here, Checking Progressive Privilege. It is great. And, you know, Carrie, one thing that just occurred to me was that, and you mentioned this too, that in a sense, progressive privilege kind of places an extra sort of burden, I guess, on women, doesn't it?
You know, absolutely. I think when you look at the most pronounced examples or the biggest difference in how the media certainly treats people and benefits the left, certainly when it comes to women, open a women's magazine, something that you're supposed to, you might pick up if you wanted fashion advice or something, you know, look at silly celebrities, stories, and you'll often see, and, you know, a decidedly progressive political worldview that includes the fawning coverage of liberal politicians. You know, they have spreads of, you know, Michelle Obama is constantly being lauded. Mm-hmm. Democratic candidates are always, you know, airbrushed to look just magnificent and aspirational. And if conservatives are covered, which they very rarely are, but if they are, it's very negative It's hostile. You know, unless they're going to say something bad about Republicans, which is one of the few ways that a Republican can get it in there if they want to complain about the Republican Party. But it's incredibly lopsided. And I think it's one of those things that if you hear so often this kind of lament in the media, why are there so few Republican women? You know, Democrats have all these women. Why do so few Republican women run for office? Well, one of the reasons is things like this. You see how Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Kellyanne Conway and some of these women in power, in powerful positions, how they're treated? You know, they're harassed. Their families are harassed. Their weight and their looks are made fun of. You know, no wonder if women aren't signing up for this. It's you know, there's real consequences to it.
You know, I think just us talking about this and people thinking about this idea of progressive privilege is it's just a step forward in a sense, because we do take it for granted. Like, I'm just thinking, wow, how many years have I picked up a magazine, like you said, and not been surprised at my views being denigrated? I just expect it.
Exactly. You take it for granted. You kind of learn to brush it off. It's funny. One of the ones that when I started kind of you're paying attention to this and preparing to write this book, one thing that I found that was really eye-opening to me was the number of times, you know, I would turn on the television, and my husband and I mostly watch, you know, Amazon or Netflix, or just poke around at those shows, and we turn something on that you think is purely for entertainment, and then have this cartoonish character of, you know, a conservative, you know, they show somebody who's Southern, he has a gun, you know, you're trying to, you know, almost paint like a cartoonish version of a Republican, and he always turns out to be, you know, the bad guy, the hypocrite, the sexist, the homophobe. It's so often that it pervades our culture that, you know, it's easy not to notice it, but if you start paying attention, you'll see, you know, it's not just, you know, late night comedy shows, entertainment shows, you know, the award shows. You expect, if you turn on the Emmy Awards or some other thing like that, you're going to hear progressive lectures, frankly. It's become lectures on the superior of the progressive point of view. You know, that's not really normal. Politics shouldn't be everywhere, and it shouldn't be so completely lopsided.
So we don't want to cede all this ground to the left in all the areas of culture. How do we graciously get it back?
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I do think one of the problems that we see today is that I don't think there's no easy solution, because I think it's fabulous that we have you know, conservatives have obviously now, there are new talk shows, there's you know, there's television that caters to conservatives, mm-hmm. there's you know, clearly radio shows, there's online, but I do think that's kind of a problem. We don't want to have just totally two-tiered media and segregated media that just, you know, becomes an echo chamber. I think that's bad for conservatives. I do think we need to be challenged and not just, you know, remember that sometimes our guys make mistakes. We need an honest media that's not just looking to cheerlead for Republican ideas or Republican champions. You know, we need to have this kind of bipartisan grounds. That's why I think that, you know, as much as I'm, you know, grateful for the outlets, the conservative outlets we have, I do think that we need to continue to try to, you know, talk about it, point out the unfairness, try to be respectful, but to point this out is, you know, you wouldn't treat another group like this. You wouldn't treat, you know, frankly, what you can consider conservatives a minority. They wouldn't, you know, treat another minority group like this. Why is it that they so often demonize them? So I think having those conversations and kind of trying to gently point things out, model civility. I do think, you know, that's something that is hard in today's age. You know, obviously, especially with, you know, the president sometimes says a lot of things that I don't think come across. I think he could do a better job. I think it's, you know, we can be honest about that and say, I love a lot of his policies. I wish we had a better tone. So I think trying to, you know, elevate, I think those are some of the ways we can kind of at least, you know, start chipping away at this. But it's going to take a long time. We really have had such a lopsided culture for a long that it's no easy road back.
Right. You know, you mentioned this whole idea of sort of a confirmation bias, where we just, since we have so many choices, we choose the outlets that confirm what we already believe. And, you know, that is, I think, can be very dangerous, and also is a recipe for not staying sharp. And so I know that one of our hosts here, Nick Pitts, reads the New York Times, and I read the Washington Post every day, and just because I don't want to only read conservative papers and things, because then I will not see what the other side is thinking. And, you know, sometimes you need to read a columnist who is liberal and just kind of think about who that person is as a person. They are a person. They may just be totally wrong in your mind, but they're a person.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. I mean, another thing I think is really important is to try to get our politics to be more of conversations again. I think that I feel this is a unique point. I think that a lot of people have said just the role of Twitter and social media has encouraged such a race to the bottom. It's funny because I feel like anytime I do something or if I'm involved in like local politics. If you go down and work at the polls or work at the, voting booths or whatever, at your local, I guarantee you that if you're a Republican, if you're a Democrat, you're going to really like the people on the other side. I have a very vivid, pleasant memories of standing outside in the pouring rain, under an umbrella with my, brought a couple of my kids, and the nicest people from the Democrats, you came over and gave us, they had little hot hand warmers to hold. They could not have been nicer. And it's important to remember that, we're still Americans. We're still people. We're still people who are, we're rooting for the country. We're rooting for something good, even if we have very different ideas of how to get there. I think if we could get back to remembering that, that would really help. But, not to just read that kind of hateful idea of these guys as the enemy, because that's not how it wasn't supposed to be like that. I don't think it was so much like that, not that long ago.
Carrie, thank you so much for bringing up these points to us here on Point of View. I appreciate your thoughtfulness about it, and also this Encounter Broadside that you've written. I think it's an important little piece for people to get.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, Carrie. And ladies and gentlemen, you can go to pointofview.net, and you can find Carrie's picture and click through to the Independent Women's Forum, find out all about them. You could also see the book, and you can certainly order this. I mean, I would recommend this little booklet because it's only, it's 40 pages long. I read it just very quickly, and it's encouraging. You know, we started the show with Van Taylor from the 3rd District here in Texas. He's a congressman. That's one of his key goals in Congress is to reach out to the other side and have dialogue with them. So we started the show with that. We ended it with Carrie. I think it was kind of a good way to circle around. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining me today. I will be hosting again on Friday. Kirby will be here tomorrow. So have a great night.
Is religious freedom still a cornerstone of the Republic, or has it effectively been crushed by the forces of tolerance? America needs Christians to be informed and as unified as possible, applying God's wisdom to civic life. Point of View can be a key part of a successful mission. I believe in America. I believe God wants His best for us. We can face whatever the world throws at us as long as we stand together. If you have not signed on, please do it now. Support Point of View Radio today at pointofview.net. Set up your monthly gift by clicking the Truth Team 360 picture and then carefully follow the directions. pointofview.net. By phone, you can give at 1-800-347-5151. 800-347-5151. Or mail that first donation to Point of View, Box 30, Dallas, Texas 75221. Box 30, Dallas 75221. Or call us 800-347-5151.
Point of View is produced by Point of View Ministries.